News, sports, weather from Dr. Bill Williams, traffic info from Kane, and one of the Gulf Coast's most familiar voices. It's Mobile Mornings with Dan Brennan and Dalton Arwig.
Morning. It is Tuesday morning on FM Talk 106.5. It's 7 minutes after 8 o'clock. Glad to have you listening, as always, to Mobile Mornings and FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, and it is a Tuesday morning. That means it's time to be joined by our Tuesday guest, Quinn Hillier. You can read his work at quinnhillier.com, also on the Washington Examiner, and the Mad Jones Trilogy available on Amazon. Quinn, thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks, guys. Glad to be on with y'all.
So a lot we want to get to during our short amount of time with you, including Arthur Orr's math reform bill and also this football coach who praying on the field, now former Attorney General and Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions involved. But let's start with the top story, and that's Ukraine. And I want to get into the energy market thing, but first, I think in order to avoid what right now almost seems inevitable, which would be a war involving the United States and Russia in some form or fashion, that Putin would need an off-ramp where he wouldn't be entirely emasculated. This is my words. And yesterday, Russia, and likely lying to Ukraine, said, "We will stop fighting. We'll completely quit killing people. All you have to do is lay down your arms and give us Crimea, Donetsk, and Luhansk." What's your opinion on what kind of off-ramp should be afforded to Putin, if any?
None that involves any loss by the Ukrainians. Any loss by the Ukrainians. Otherwise, emasculate away. Seriously. Look, he might not be long for this world. The Russian people are feeling it. Obviously, the oligarchs are feeling it. The generals are embarrassed. And I think you keep the pressure on him because I think there could be a coup, and I think they could get rid of him. And then, you know, and then the victors determine the terms, and that we would be the free world would be the victors, and what we would ask is not that Russia give up anything that is rightly its, but that it give up everything that it has taken from Ukraine.
You know, looking at the United Nations Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights announced yesterday, 406 civilians have been killed, 801 have been injured since the fighting began back in February. Of those 406 deceased, 27 are children. Mm. Just a few things that you can put in your pipe and smoke away and try to understand the human aspect of this terrible, tragic story.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's no excuse for this, and it could have been avoided if the West had gotten tough with crippling sanctions as punishment for Russia amassing its troops, and then said, "You don't like the sanctions? You back down, draw down your troops, and then we'll lift the sanctions and go about our business."
Right.
But they needed to deter this humanitarian crisis, not react to it. And that was, that's why I think the entire West has been a little too little and a lot too late, including Joe Biden.
Yeah, and Biden kind of now between a rock and a hard place, but he put himself in that situation, seemingly. And that's all of these sanctions that have been announced, we have still not directly touched Russian oil. And now there's discussion that the U.S. would ban the import of Russian oil, not the rest of Europe. And the U.S., I read that Russia, about 5% of their oil output comes to the U.S. So it wouldn't be a lethal hit to Russia if only the U.S. banned that import.
Mm-hmm.
But Quinn, now we're talking about getting our fuel from Venezuela, Iran, Saudi Arabia. I mean, trade one evil dictator for three, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, at least the Saudis, as awful as they are geopolitically aligned with us. And they have had some liberalizing in some ways in their society.
They let women drive now.
I can see in a pinch going to them. But going to Iran and going to Venezuela, that's sickening, especially at the same time that the word is Biden is about to sign off on another nuclear agreement with Iran that, get this, that was largely negotiated by the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
What is in this man's head? There's something wrong with him and his administration and anybody who thinks this way.
Yeah, I don't know that it's him, because he doesn't seem like he's 100% capable of actually being the guy right now. I don't know, but finally, we have something come up where Quinn Hillier agrees with members of the squad. They kind of bounced back or bit back a little bit about those possible oil streams. Yeah, right.
Well, look, the answer is simple. The answer is take away all the restrictions other than environmental on U.S. and Canadian and other free world, but obviously we're concerned with the U.S., production of oil and gas and coal and develop markets for our companies. And we can use shale and fracking and stuff like that, send LNG, liquefied natural gas, over to Europe, help them. This is our chance, and get this. We produce it more cleanly than Venezuela and Iran and basically almost every other country in the world. So if you're going to have fossil fuels, it's better in if they are produced in America, where we have these environmental regulations and better equipment, et cetera, than to rely on Iran and Venezuela. And that's not even taking into account how brutal and vicious their regimes are.
Well said, Quinn. And one more thing on this Russia-Ukraine situation before we get into some of these other topics. We've kind of been describing this war as maybe the first wide scale cancel culture war, and using canceling at least publicly to try to get Russia to get out of Ukraine. And we've seen so many companies, especially the banks that have gotten involved, Amex, MasterCard, Visa, they've withdrawn their cards, PayPal. It's become really difficult to do, you know, things that we're used to doing daily here in America, you can't do in Russia. But McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and Pepsi continue selling there. And now Americans are calling for boycotts of those companies. I wanted to get your overall thoughts on this cancel culture thing being used during war.
Cancel culture is more like public shaming through social media or the heckler's veto and shouting down people. This is something else. This is basically private sector sanctions.
Right.
And private sector sanctions in a situation like this are good. And for a read into Coca-Cola, I urge people to go to Washington Examiner to a piece just out yesterday by my young colleague, Zach Faria, F-A-R-I-A, about how two-faced, how hypocritical Coca-Cola is to have gone nuts over a perfectly legitimate, by the way, voting law in
Georgia,
the state of Georgia, U.S. Georgia, and yet keep putting out all these statements saying, well, we're going to honor our commitments in Russia. What is wrong with those people? I haven't had a Coke. I haven't drunk a Coca-Cola since last March. And I think it's time that everybody starts thinking about doing the same thing, because they kowtow to foreign dictators, to brutal human rights oppressors, but then they take off, they take stands against a state that's doing nothing wrong.
I'm going to start flying my RC Cola flag.
I've been drinking RC Cola for a year now.
I didn't even know it was available. But we're going to get into around the break.
Let's get into some state stuff when we get back here. Quinn, I know you have a lot to say about Arthur Orr's education bill, so we'll hit that when we get back.
All right, on the way, Quinn Hillier, Dan, and Dalton on FM Talk 106.5, Mobile Mornings. Also, John Eads, the co-founder and executive director of Light of the Village, will join us after 8:30.
Quick addendum to that traffic recently happening here. According to a texter, the Bayway westbound slowed down. Looks like police activity. I think they've got someone pulled over on the right shoulder. That's westbound on the Bayway. Texter says, backing up, not a wreck. It is police activity.
So when the Bayway backs up, it's known as the K-Way.
That's right. You coined that, I believe.
I think a texter did.
Oh.
I was a little...
See, that was your opportunity to take complete credit for it.
I'm going to come clean here. Because when it happened, there's a lot of... Our listeners listen. So if they saw me fraudulently take credit for that, they would call me out. We continue our conversation with Quinn Hillier, quinnhillier.com, and also the Washington Examiner.
Yeah, so Quinn, to get into some state politics here, as the general session, the regular session continues in Montgomery today, we had the Literacy Act that was much discussed, and now a math bill that's kind of similar, but filed by Senator Arthur Orr. Explain this math bill to us and where Senator Orr is right and where he's wrong.
Okay, well, I think this is a bill with a lot of good intentions, but it is extraordinarily misplaced. Look, Alabama is doing terribly, according to every indicator, doing terribly in educating our children in math, even though just 12 years ago, we had moved all the way up to the middle of the states. It was either 24th or 25th. Now we're back down to, by various measures, either 47th, 49th, or even 52nd. So we need to do something about math. The problem is he is trying to legislate things that are not necessarily best legislated. And so, I mean, that's why we have a state board of education to get into policy details. I've got no problem with the legislature setting broad policy and even overruling the state school board when appropriate. But this bill is 52 pages long. It goes into extraordinary detail on what to include in math instruction, as if these legislators are supposed to be math experts. It sets up several new major layers of bureaucracy and does it all by law, rather than if you do it by the State Board of Education and they set policy, and if they get it wrong, all it takes is five of their nine votes to undo it. Here, you know how hard it is to go through the entire legislative process. This would codify all sorts of bureaucracy and all sorts of nonsense that is not best put into law. So that's the first big problem with it. Second problem is, if you go into the details, and I read the entire bill yesterday, they have several paragraphs in there with all of this diversity stuff, which might sound good, but you don't teach math according to race or color.
Mm-hmm.
Math does not know race or color. So why do you need to tell educators that they need to take into account the historical roots of diversity and inequities?
Right.
That should not be in a math bill. Okay, so that's a big problem. And then finally, he says that he's trying to cancel Common Core, which you've heard me talk about. It's great to cancel Common Core math. Before we did Common Core math, we had moved up to 24th. As soon as we did Common Core math, we started sliding back again. The problem is he continues to make the same mistake that Governor Ivey's team has made and others have made, and that is he outlaws anything called officially Common Core.
Right.
But then they come in the back door, they change one or two words in all of these standards and say, see, this isn't technically Common Core, but it's still the same thing. He doesn't outlaw the use of Common Core as a basis. He just outlaws something officially called Common Core.
So basically,
and that lets the education bureaucracy come in and stick with what is not working already, which is Common Core.
So Dalton's going to have his kids come home with, say, third grade math, and he's not going to understand the process by which they get through it.
Mm-hmm.
You won't even be able to participate. Like parents don't understand the Common Core.
Yeah. Because it's done in a completely different manner, I guess.
Right,
yeah.
Right,
exactly. So that's what's happening now. And to his credit, Arthur Orr, in part of his bill, is trying to ban Common Core. The problem is he defines it as this formal structure, this formal thing, and bans that, but he doesn't ban any knockoffs.
And Quinn, how does this square with the conservative movement to have parents more involved in their children's education and to keep the school boards and the state out of it?
Well,
I know it's impossible to keep the state out completely and
boards should do education policy, but they should be responsive to parental concerns. And this doesn't really affect that much, except that it mandates all these new layers of bureaucracy, of math coaches, et cetera, et cetera. And then when it lists all the things that they are supposed to be proficient in, it starts to get into the same educrates, bureaucrates of education lingo, and it's a little worrisome, and especially worrisome if you put it into state law in a way that's not easy to undo.
And really quickly, you've got an article you posted yesterday, and this involves Jeff Sessions, Mobilian, former attorney general, also former senator, and he's agreeing with five other former attorneys general. You know, we had some stories, it seemed back-to-back-to-back, about these high school coaches getting in trouble for praying with their players on the field. How does that tie in? What does Sessions have to say about particular coach?
There's a case that has been accepted by the Supreme Court, so they will probably actually consider the case later this spring, and if not, then in the fall, about a high school coach in Seattle who did just that after a game, 15 to 30 seconds, doesn't require the kids to join him, anything like that. It's going to the Supreme Court. Jeff Sessions led the way in this. This was his initiative. He had a brief written called an amicus, a friend of the court brief, and he got five former attorney generals. So now there's six former attorney generals coming in on the side of this coach and expressly, explicitly asking the Supreme Court to overthrow the bad precedent that other courts and school officials have misinterpreted to say that you can't do any school in any public, I mean, any prayer in any public setting. And they're saying that that precedent should be overthrown and coaches should be allowed to pray. That's with Jeff Sessions. He's leading the way on this. It's very rare for six former attorney generals to say, let's overturn a court precedent, a Supreme Court.
Folks should read that. Latest from Quinn Hillier at Washington Examiner. You can also follow Quinn on Twitter at Quinn Hillier. Quinn, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
John Eads, Light of the Village, on the way next on FM Talk 106.5 with Dan and Dalton. Dan and Dalton, FM Talk 106.5. A quick addendum to that traffic.
Yes, sir. Well, we mentioned in that last segment about the police having someone pulled over. Looks like no police presence now. Bayway all clear, according to Leanna, who's in the other room,
okay.
and Michael, who I don't know where he is, but he texted us. So thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael, very much. 8:34.
Yeah, and this segment brought to you by Tobias McCormick & Comer, local law firm who've been doing business in Mobile and the surrounding area for, well, over five decades now. If you heard my conversation yesterday with Brian Comer and Trooper Peoples from Aaliyah, it is pedestrian safety awareness that they are trying to bring right now, and especially with Mardi Gras just wrapping up last week, that was there was a lot of potential for bad accidents involving pedestrians over these last few weeks. It seems like we did a pretty good job, pretty safe Mardi Gras this season, but you have to keep in mind that that your life could change in just a couple seconds if you're not paying full attention, whether you're in a vehicle or walking across the street. It's very important that you pay attention to pedestrians. Some stats for you here. I think we talked about these yesterday. There were 769 pedestrian-related traffic crashes last year that resulted in 125 pedestrian fatalities. That was just in Alabama and just last year. Those numbers. So whether you're out for a neighborhood stroll or navigating a crowded city street, you need to try to remain alert of your surroundings and be watchful for traffic. There are many tips they have for you at Tobias McCormick & Comer. That's T tmclawyers.com. Also, if you want a free consultation, you can call them anytime. That number is on the front page of their website at tmclawyers.com. And check them out today, Tobias McCormick and Comer. And we appreciate their support.
Always nice when I have a friend in studio, which I have right now. John Eads is co-founder and executive director of Light of the Village. We could talk about Light of the Village for, we could take up another hour on this show for sure, Dalton.
Yes, sir.
John, just for those who are not aware of what Light of the Village is, I know a lot of people are, but they might have a concrete understanding of exactly what it is. Talk about the roots of the ministry and also the growth of the ministry and some of the services it provides.
Sure. No, I first off appreciate y'all letting us speak and talk a little bit about it. Yeah, we started basically 25 years ago when I was in San Antonio getting my master's in healthcare administration. My wife and I felt called to get involved in prison ministry. And that evolved into some housing project ministry out there in San Antonio, part-time, right? My wife was a special education teacher, and that was her career. I was a hospital administrator, and that was my career. The infirmary recruited me out to Mobile. We moved out to Mobile in 1997. We continued on that path of working inside prisons there in Atmore and other places, and then started working with youth also. And in 2001, there was a big police ambush in the Queens Corps apartments that some people may remember. And we felt God nudge us to make a more kind of a steady, constant impact inside one of these neighborhoods, right? And that's where we started. On December 20th of 2001, we began Light of the Village in the Queens Court Apartments. That apartment complex was closed a few months later, and then we sought out another neighborhood, and Alabama Village was perfect. And that's where God put us. Mm-hmm. And so we went there, found an old house. It was actually being used as a, well, they called them crack houses. They don't really call them that anymore. But it was a crack house at the time, and we were able to purchase it through the ministry. And slowly but surely it built. We really thought it would just be maybe a 1 or 2 day a month kind of Christian duty kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, that was not God's plan. Mm. And as we worked that neighborhood, met more people, developed relationships, it just continued to grow slowly but steadily. And in 2007 is when we kind of hit our main point where both Dolores and I had to reevaluate our careers because the ministry had gotten so big. It was time to switch. And so we went basically like we are today, 5 days a week. And it's just been amazing to meet the people. The community out there calls it God's house and our home, which is, it's huge. It's not John and D'Lo's house. They called Dolores D'Lo. It's not our house. It's God's house first, but the community calls it their home, which is so amazing and remarkable. And so with that, our services have been adjusted over the years. Primarily, we work with young people, you know, doing Bible studies in the afternoon, after school programs, tutoring, those types of things. And then in 2007, those little kids that we met back in 2001, 2002 were getting older. So then we started a teenage program. I went out to Los Angeles to learn about gang intervention. I didn't know anything about it. I realized that. So, boom, we went out there to find the nation's best practice for gang intervention. Father Greg Boyles does that. Been out there several times. And then they started coming here to evaluate our program and to help us to, again, build those genuine relationships with the people in the community. And so that was pretty good. And then, of course, we started adult programs as well. So, as we look at it today, we were able to make it a full circle ministry, again, to build individual relationships with kids, with teenagers, with adults. And it's been fantastic. And of course, it's a Christian ministry. It's not a social service program. It's a straight up ministry, man, and not from the suite, but from the street. And it's been an amazing ride. And we don't feel, really that it humbles us, right?
Yeah.
That we've been given this mission, and it's so serious, man.
By the way, Dalton, I've been along for the ride as a board member for maybe 14 years now, or something like that. But that's the thing that will strike you about it. It's so genuine, mm-hmm. and it's so one-on-one, and knowing all the kids' names and their stories. And it can be kind of upsetting because some of the stories are they're hard to listen to.
I can't imagine. And I think of so many charities that we've all heard of that mean well, but it must do something entirely different when when you've been here 20 years and you're able to really put roots down. Some of these charities that raise money, it's all great, but to actually physically try to help these kids in a neighborhood, generations, you've gone now one full generation,
yeah.
That has to be, you must be able to do a lot more change when you're able to stay in a place and really get to know the people.
Absolutely. You know, being consistent, being genuine are the keys. I mean, again, to reflect the faith, love, and hope, you know, of Christ, of course, it is requires that, to be genuine, to be sincere, and to endure hardship. You know, Dan is familiar. We have our memorial wall. You know, as of last month, we've buried 48 people.
Oh, my goodness.
All taken violently over the years, and these are people we know, and people that Dan knows. I mean, it's not a fairy tale, you know. It's a tough ride, but at the same time, you have to kind of go, you know, like the Bible says, where death casts its shadow, a light has shined. Absolutely, and it's not our light. We just reflect it and get to see it.
And I also want people to know that John also has got a side to him. He's a former paratrooper, and he holds these kids to a standard. Mm-hmm. And I've been in an occasion where a Bible study with John, and then the kids are acting up a little bit, and then he says, "Would you like to? You think it's funny? Is it funny that I'm the one that goes down to the morgue?" To identify, and the room quiets up, and everybody's back in line pretty quickly because they know the depth of his love and concern for them, and they respect him, and it's something really special to see. Thank you for allowing me to witness all that.
Yes, sir.
And it's been amazing the opportunity I've had.
And John, we just got done talking with Quinn Hillier about some of the failings in education in the state, which, you know, no one by themselves can solve. But I know you guys are also helping the youth with their schooling and helping them get through school, and maybe not even just with what they're supposed to be learning, but just getting to work and getting the stuff done that they're supposed to get done, right?
Exactly right. And it's like Dan says, to control the room, that took about 10 years to earn that respect. Mm. Again, these kids don't fear anything. So somebody thinks, well, I'm a big, you know, scary person. They don't care. Mm. But it's that respect. And in all honesty, and you've seen this too, Dan, my wife, D'Lo, can handle the room even better. And some of our staff, you know, that have been there for many years.
D'Lo's,
like, you know, Biz
five
and
foot,
Morgan. And,
5 foot one, D'Lo. Oh,
yeah. And they will listen only because of that respect, because that relationship has been built.
Yeah.
Education, a huge part of it. And what's been amazing, Dalton, is that so many volunteers now can come, like today for our after school program, a myriad of volunteers, I mean, older people, younger people, white, black, the race doesn't matter. They will come and sit down with these kids and help them, you know, learn how to read one-on-one.
Mm.
Fantastic. And so, and then the kids, to see the kids get all excited to grow. And then whoever is their caregiver, whether it be their mother, grandmother, whatever, they get excited too because their kids are learning. And this helps the school teachers who, let's be honest, have a very tough job.
Mm-hmm.
Dan's been with me when I pick up, I drive the band to pick up at Whitley Elementary. But what a great relationship we have with that school system.
Right.
So it's so much about relationships and building that with a variety of folks, whether it be the local schools. The Parks and Recs allow us to go into several facilities and do the program, not just during the after-school programs, but during the summer. And, fantastic. And as you guys know, you know, we don't charge a dime. We don't want any child to be prohibited from coming because they can't come up with those funds, right? And so it's amazing. I mean, it really is.
So one of the days I was there, Dalton, this was years ago, a little guy showed up. He lived across the creek in the apartments.
Uh-huh. In Gulf Village.
Gulf Village. Yeah. And he showed up, and there was no parent or anybody around him. He was really young. He was like 4 years old, and John said, oh, he's been coming over here since he was two.
Mm-hmm.
So this kid would just show up. He knew where the fun was, and it wasn't a long walk, but it was a long walk when you consider he's by himself and he's that young.
Right.
And so that's the kind of thing that goes on there. And now we've got a special evening, and it's kind of for the supporters, but it's also for people that don't know about Light of the Village. Can you talk about that, when it is, and what it's all about?
Sure. We call it the Night in the Light event. And some people assume it's just a fundraiser. It is not a fundraiser per se. It's a celebration. We want to, again, confirm people that have made donations over the years, because about 78% of our donations come from individuals, which is just awesome. And we want them to feel, you know, have a night where they can celebrate what that money has gone towards. And so what we do is we come together and we keep it quick. We have good food. Chef Rob provides food. We spend a little extra to make the night special. So when people come, they leave wanting more. And, of course, Dan, you're our MC, so we appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And basically what we do is we give an overview of the ministry, how we got there, how we are today as far as our protocols and, you know, how we handle money and our board and so forth. But then this year is really special. Joseph Brennan, who you know very well, who's done several videos for us, he has actually followed our staff around for the last year and is going to showcase their stories.
Wow.
And yeah, it's one of those questions that have been asked for us for a couple of years. You know, tell us more about the staff, because we have 8 people on our staff, and Dolores and I are actually the lowest paid members of our staff, which is perfect, because, again, we want to invest in the ministry to last longer than us. But the other 6 members, you know, their stories are amazing, and they've dedicated their lives to this. And in fact, our average length of employment is over 10 years.
That's amazing, because it is such hard work.
It's hard work. I mean, and so this night, this special night, which again will be on the 24th, the Thursday night, at starting at 6:30 out at the grounds, we're going to do the basics, and then we're going to see this film and really celebrate those who serve.
So, awesome. So folks that maybe you didn't even somehow mm-hmm. even hear about Light of the Village this interview, they can also come?
Absolutely, okay. Yes. In fact, you go to our website, lightofthevillage.org. Just it's right on there. Just scroll down and you will see the event mentioned.
There's also a little film that's kind of that can give you a better idea of what Light of the Village is, and then you can buy your tickets online.
Fantastic. Yes, sir.
And
absolutely.
That's really well done. Also, if someone can't make it out for that and they want to volunteer or otherwise donate, how can they do so?
Fantastic. The first thing, you know, go to the website. It's all there. And even if you're just kind of interested, what we suggest is kind of what Mother Teresa used to say, come out and see the place.
Yeah.
Come out and take a tour with us. We'd love for you to see not just the neighborhood and all that, but no, see the kids learning, see the kids being kids. And so we're always open for people to come out and visit.
Mm-hmm.
Call us first so we can meet you and make sure you don't get lost, because there's not many street signs out there. And let us show you around and then see where God leads you from there, whether it is to volunteer, to support it, whatever it may be. It's fantastic.
I got to get you out there, man. It's just remarkable, and the tour is amazing, because you get the entire clear picture of what's being done and what's surrounding you. What's surrounding you, you know, by and large, is not real good. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of people who've got nothing to lose, and you're really swimming uphill, upstream. But it's done every day out there. So, John, I applaud you as always, and we look forward to a great night.
Yes, sir. Thank y'all very much.
That's March 24th, Night in the Light. Again, lightofthevillage.org, lightofthevillage.org for more information.
It is 8:49 FM Talk 106.5. Dan Brennan, Dalton Norwig, and Jeff Poor on the way, beginning a little after 9. Hey, y'all, good morning. Dan Brennan, Dalton Norwig, FM Talk 106.5, 8:54. Well, we were in the presence of quite a man right there, huh?
Yeah, he's John. Wow, the things he's done over the last 20 years for this community. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Really, really amazing. Again, lightofthevillage.org is where you want to go to find out more about everything.
Go ahead, great to talk to him. Hey, coming up on the Jeff Poor Show, he'll talk with Dan Gaynor from the Media Research Center. That coming up at around 9:30. In the 10 o'clock hour, Ag Commissioner Rick Pate. I love hearing him talk on the air. And then in the third and final hour of the Jeff Poor Show, he has State Senator Steve Livingston on the way and Ray Mellick, one of Jeff's many bosses.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jeff's there now, 18, 19.
I like how 18, Jeff... 18, 19 years, that's right. I like how Jeff talks about his bosses. Like anyone could could tell Jeff what to do. It's just not happening.
He's back there in Sean's office right now, and I don't know if Sean's telling him or if he's telling Sean, but they're having a conversation right now.
So looking forward to that. The big news this hour, and you kind of figured this was coming, the Biden administration is planning to ban Russian oil imports. An announcement on the issue is imminent. Now, you would think this would be a major, major hit to Russia. What I've read is that the U.S. actually takes in about, of all the oil that Russia sells, we make up about 5% of their output.
Okay, not
so
much.
So it's not huge. Europe is still, there's a reason they say that Europe got too tied into Russia and getting their energy from Russia, and that's because even if they wanted to quit getting Russian oil, they can't do it right now.
No.
It's too cold.
No.
They need that heat.
They're stuck.
And they don't have an immediate plan to switch it out. Meanwhile, you listen to Pete Buttigieg, the transportation secretary who held a press conference yesterday, and Jennifer Psaki, they are still very committed to clean energy, renewable energy. They say that can happen much faster and in a safer manner than encouraging oil suppliers in the United States to drill more. That was actually what Psaki said yesterday as Peter Ducey was going after. She said, well, there are 95 permits for companies to drill, and they're not drilling. And everyone online said, boom. Got Peter Ducey with that one. Well, the truth is there are a lot of regulations and incentives for them to not drill. Mm-hmm. So maybe if they made it a little more incentivized for American oil producers to start producing that oil again. And then, of course, we've talked about the pipeline and all of that. But
was that day one of his administration? Was that day one?
That was one of the first things he did. Something I wanted to get into more today that I do want to spend a lot more time tomorrow is talking about the thing that no one wants to talk about, and that's the immediate threat of nuclear war. And how far is Putin willing to push this? I talked about him being emasculated earlier with Quinn Hillier, and I think that plays a major role in this. Whether Putin can get out of this trap that he's gotten into and do it in a way that keeps him and his country from feeling like they've lost everything. Because a man who's lost everything is a dangerous man.
No doubt.
And I think that he feels that he has the edge on the U.S. and the rest of the world in many different ways. The main way being that he is looking at us and knows that Americans, for the most part, do not have the stomach to do this big game of chicken with him, that he's willing to push the button. Are we? If we're talking about mutually assured destruction, he could care a whole lot less than Americans right now. That's the feeling I get. But on
and
top
he doesn't have the history of being any different than he is right now. This is who the guy is.
Yeah, exactly. And he may have pulled the wool over some people's eyes for decades, but right now when they're asking how crazy is he, well, that's exactly what he wants you to ask. Mm-hmm. He wants you to think he's insane because then nothing's off the table. But in addition to that, we have fallen behind. When we talk about the nuclear arms race, we just had another failure in a hypersonic missile test. We can't get, so far we have not gotten these hypersonic missiles down. Both China and Russia have mostly figured it out. We're behind in the nuclear arms race. And that's, I think, a big reason why we haven't moved in.
Pretty scary. 859 FM Talk 106.5. Dalton mentioned that Jeff Poore is next. And he is.